Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, famous quotes, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous hosts, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Raven Puff Common Room.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 15, The Forbidden Forest, and Chapter 16, Through the Trapdoor. In these chapters, none of the teachers have any problem with their youngest students trekking in the Forbidden Forest, which has the word forbidden in its name for a reason. And the Golden Trio venture beyond the trapdoor to enter a sort of dungeon with various magical, physical, and intellectual challenges, very reminiscent of my times playing The Legend of Zelda in my teenage years.
Oh, nice.
And joining us for this episode is another gothic writer and enthusiast. Please welcome the one, the only, Morgan Chalfont. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, it's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Yay. Morgan has been a reoccurring guest speaker for our Sublimely Gothic podcast. He joined us for Dracula, Frankenstein, and other gothic classics. I'll have his details in the description box for this episode. But now he returns to us to share his thoughts on The Boy Who Lived. So, again, thank you so much for joining us, Morgan.
Yeah, awesome. You're welcome.
I'm curious, both for Jess, who, again, this is kind of her first time reading the book in a long, long time, and Morgan, you kind of just getting fresh eyes with this as well. What was your impressions of the two chapters?
Well, okay, so this came out when I was in junior high. The original Scholastic version, like the little paperback, was in our library. And my good friend, my best friend, he read all of the books. And I never read any of them growing up. I knew about them, but I guess I was a little bit colored in a good or bad way, because I've seen all of the movies sporadically throughout the years, just in picking them up and, you know, getting bored and watching one or two. So I have kind of a basis for it. It is interesting to kind of see what the printed page type of thing looks like and see some of the differences and the amount of time spent on certain elements and stuff. So yeah, it's interesting. And it does have some stuff in here that I probably would have really enjoyed when I was younger, not enjoy now, but yeah, anyway.
What about you, Jess?
Amy, the more I read these books, and I think having read these chapters, is I'm realizing more and more, I don't know if I actually ever read this. I think I may have seen the movie. And because there are a lot more characters, there's a lot more color, there's a lot more just nuance to it than I could recall. And I'm going through this chapter and I'm like, there's centaurs? Like, what is going on here? So, which was really awesome. And the unicorn, I mean, we'll talk about that. Again, I feel like I say this a lot on this podcast. This chapter in particular was the first chapter of the two. Chapter 15 was surprisingly dark. Well, 16 was dark too, but like, I just keep, you know, the hints of darkness that are peppered throughout this, what is a children's book, you know, originally, or what it was written for, is just always kind of surprising to me. It's a happy surprise, but it's always very surprising. So how about your reread of this, this go round?
Yeah, it was just interesting specifically reading it, like trying to interpret things from a gothic perspective. And I'm just like, yeah, Forbidden Forest. There's a lot there.
There is.
For obvious reasons. But let us begin with chapter 15, The Forbidden Forest. And the chapter begins with Harry and Hermione getting busted because they were dum-dums and left the invisibility cloak on the top of the tower while they were getting rid of Norbert the dragon.
Yeah, they get into the like cliffhanger ending for these couple of chapters. And, you know, I'm following your orders not to read ahead. They're doing these cliffhangers and I'm like, oh, God. And them getting into a little bit of of trouble leaving the invisibility cloak. I don't know if we're getting there yet, but I just love how they get kind of busted for what Draco did to them for, you know, kind of flipping that around.
From the chapter with the midnight duel.
Yes, exactly. Professor McGonagall says, it doesn't take a genius to work it out. You fed Draco Malfoy some cock and bull story about a dragon trying to get him out of bed and get him into trouble, which is exactly what Draco did to them.
Yeah, would have happily done to them. I discussed in the previous episode my theory of maybe Dumbledore knew about this dragon smuggling and just let it happen to keep everything quiet. And so by extension, I am suspicious of whether McGonagall knows or not.
Okay.
Which, again, if she does know, then it makes this punishment really, really mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
It makes it really mean, but at the same time, because Draco and Neville, like other students, are involved, she has to like put on this show of being really pissed off.
Right. Yeah, he can't just slide by with like
this. Especially given who we know Draco Malfoy's father is. Like, definitely if he were to catch wind of McGonagall covering something up, like that would be bad. So again, I'm not as convinced. I'm definitely in the camp of Dumbledore definitely knew, but with McGonagall, I feel like it could be 50-50.
In the like relation to the story, like I like your theory, Amy, because I mean just knowing what we know, which I mean I guess we don't know like a huge amount of his backstory yet, but Dumbledore as this kind of all powerful wizard, like it's hard to believe that a guy of that stature and somebody who has been in that position for as long as he has doesn't know every inner working that is happening underneath the roof or outside it.
So, and I felt so bad for Neville in this chapter because Neville came out just to warn them.
Right.
And I'm really mad at Harry and Hermione for not trying to explain themselves at least a little better to Neville. Maybe not in the moment when McGonagall and Malfoy are there, but even just afterwards.
Right. Yeah, they just kind of they don't really come clean or just really help him out, which it's interesting how Neville is treated throughout this. You know, it's just he's very much a friend on the periphery right now, but he's important, but they still kind of treat him like still like a little bit of an outsider. It's not like the four of them, you know, you said the golden trio. It's not everybody, but Neville's still there, you know, kind of.
Yeah. That's
making
true.
His little things or doing his little antics.
I'm sorry to laugh. I am because all it made me think of was this joke. So I remember what I heard it on, but it's they're talking about their group of friends and they're like, we are a fruit salad and you are the honeydew. Nobody likes the honeydew, but it's still necessary to be in the fruit salad. And that's all I was thinking about when it comes to Neville.
He's the honeydew of the situation. He kind of is. Yeah. I guess like Harry would be the cherry then. I don't know. I'm just thinking of like the little cups of fruit salad.
Yeah.
You had that analogy.
It just made me crack up. I don't know why that popped into my head when I was reading it, but that's the only part in here I just absolutely lost myself on. I started laughing because into my head immediately.
And to demonstrate how pissed off she is, Professor McGonagall takes 150 points from Gryffindor.
That's a lot.
That is an entire Quidditch match worth of Harry caught the snitch, and that was 150 points for Gryffindor. So that's just completely kiboshed now.
Doesn't she say, she goes, I'm going to take 50 points. And they're like, 50 points? And then she's like, from each of you.
Yeah.
Isn't she does. That, if I remember right.
She does raise the stakes in that way, and kind of reminds me of this one piece I saw video on YouTube where a girl was arrested like a teenager. I don't know what she was doing, but she was standing in front of the judge. Of course, she did something stupid and like flipped the judge off, and he just like kept upping the ante and how much she was going to be in jail. And he's like, come at me, bitch. See what happens.
Yeah. Like, why would you do this to yourself? You're already like busted, but. Oh man, I don't know. I don't know. Flipping off a judge seems like a
big. It seems pretty severe for when she knows that they're in a contest too, and it's like I'm like, because is she part of that their house? Is that right?
McGonagall is head of Gryffindor House.
That's okay. Okay, that's right. I see, like I said, I don't know. I thought that they had mentioned that she was, and it's like, okay, so you're taking 150 points out, which is huge, right, in the scope of this contest, but also you're taking it from your own house? Like, really? Jeez, you need to explain yourself, you know? Like, yeah. I don't know. I thought it. You know, if she's the head of this house, you'd think she kind of would show a little favoritism.
And that's the thing with McGonagall, or like the sort of faulty nature of this house system and this competition, because in a way it's, you know, it's good that as a head of house, she's pretty like fair and stuff. But the problem is that only works if the other teachers are just as unbiased and impartial as well. But that's not the case. So we have McGonagall, who doesn't give her own house any favors, and then on top of that we have Snape, who gives all the favoritism to Slytherin, so that the Gryffindors are just screwed.
That's unfortunate. I mean, yeah, she's kind of like super hard on her own house, which, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that's how some, you know, it's like your favorite kid or something. As a person that doesn't have kids, you know, I guess some parents are really hard on the kid that they like. That's what I've heard.
No, that's not at all true. No.
I don't know. I'm not gonna get into like my what I talked to my therapist about, but I guess that's another kind of example of favoritism, or in some weird way is how Snape treats Slytherin.
Right. And so they all totter off to bed the next day, and it becomes like common knowledge that these idiots in the first year lost all the house points and they have been socially ostracized.
Yeah. This made me have like a very depressing, by the way, you all are my therapist today, like flashback to when I was a kid, and I don't remember, you know, kids are just, and I think there was like a, let's all not talk to Jess on the bus or something. It was exactly that. And nobody would talk to me. And I just remember how hurtful that was. So I didn't do anything that I was aware of. So it's like a different kind of, not only did they do something to lose the 100 points, but then, you know, nobody's talking to them, which, and maybe I just overlooked this. Do the other kids know why they lost all these points? Or do they just know that they are like, they got busted for doing something stupid? Really stupid.
All they know is that some dumb first years were out of bed when they shouldn't have. They don't know the whole details, but they just know, again, they did something stupid and lost all the points.
I mean, that's pretty severe, I guess. Like, I don't know. But, okay, well.
Yeah, I don't know. This just made me think of, was there any experiences in high school where someone did something stupid and you're just like, damn, those freshmen.
Oh, yeah. There's a few athletic-based practices I can think of. A teammate doing something stupid and, you know, you end up, oh, hey, yeah, thanks. We're running 15 extra laps now. Thanks. You know, like that type of thing. But
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You played football. I forget.
Yeah,
I always forget that.
Yeah, but I agree with you, Jess, like on this. Like, I mean, I don't think I was not popular in high school at all. So, I mean, it was like, to a degree, this was the thing that happened like every day, with the exception of like a couple people in my class who I'm still close friends with. But yeah, I felt for them too. Like, and they're also freshmen. Like, I don't know. All of that adds up to be kind of like, really? You're doing this to your own house. You're doing this to freshmen who, you know, for all intents and purposes, should probably know the rules. But you know what? They're freshmen. Come on. Like,
right.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm projecting.
Yeah. No, I was too. So
Harry is so bummed by everything that he tries to go resign from the Quidditch team, and Wood doesn't let him. It's like, you messed up. You better play Quidditch to get all the points back.
Yeah. This, I feel like I usually can relate more to Neville than I can Harry, but this is like something that I feel like I do to myself often. You know, I'll be the first one to call myself out at like work or something, and I've had bosses be like, just shut the hell up, you're fine, you know, like something like that. So I could understand where Harry's coming from. He's like, well, I guess I'll just, you know, resign. And they're like, no, just get the damn points back. Like, do your job. That's kind of how I understood.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it says like that they only kept referring to him after that as a way of being mean, as the Seeker. And I'm like, that's cool as hell. Like, you can just call me the Seeker. Like, come on.
their exams are starting to come up, but there's a little instance where Harry notices something strange with Quirrell. What happens, Jess?
I mean, I just think about Quirrell is skittish as usual, but this time he's crying, right? He sees him, like, very visibly upset before or after his class. Is that right?
Yeah. So he hears Quirrell's voice. No, no, not again. Please. It sounded as though someone was threatening him. Harry moved closer. All right. All right, you heard Quirrell sob. Next second, Quirrell came hurrying out of the classroom, straightening his turban. He was pale and looked as though he was about to cry. So they interpret that as Quirrell has finally snapped and has spilled the beans to Snape about how to get the Philosopher's Stone.
I feel like some of this is just like knowing what transpires in the next, going forward in this chapter. It just kind of really got in my head how these kids are making all these assumptions at this point and how damaged. We've got like a chapter left, so that will, but I'm sure it also is pretty jarring to see a teacher or hear a teacher be that upset. You know, again, we're putting ourselves in the perspective of them being kids. You know, I would think a teacher was very level-headed and is there to do their job, but they're thinking of this sinister plot. Snape has done it again, you know. He's gotten to Quirrell so much so that he rattled him.
Mm-hmm. And then they get a little letter from McGonagall saying, your detention will take place at 11 o'clock tonight. Meet Mr. Filch in the entrance hall.
Whew, if that's not enough to stop you from, like, skipping out on detention, Mr. Filch.
Yeah, Morgan, what did you think of Filch's little monologue here as he's walking them to the forest?
Okay, you're gonna hate me because I'm trying to remember exactly what he said.
I highlighted it because this is one of those parts that was a little dark. It says, oh yes, hard work and pain are the best teachers, if you ask me. It's a pity they'd let the old punishments die out. Hang you by your wrists from the ceiling for a few days. I've got the chains in my office still. Keep them well oiled just in case they're ever needed. So along those lines.
From a school setting and from, it seems a little severe, but it also seems a little medieval for a school that is magic based. Like, I guess you need a wand to cast spells in Harry Potter. So I was going to say, why couldn't they just magic their way out of the chains? But I'm being overly critical. But it certainly sheds light on the introspective nature of certain characters. Like, oh, hey, some of them wish that it was a little different. And as a teacher, I can kind of get behind that a little bit.
Oh my. I hope no students are listening to you. Right, right.
Yes, they'll get glimpses of your inner Filch.
Right. If anybody ever asks me what character I am in Harry Potter, that's the one I'm going to bring up, I guess.
Oh my gosh.
Jess, when you read that again, it made me think about that I didn't think about while reading is some people criticize Harry Potter for the romanticization of boarding school life, when in reality, a lot of boarding schools in Britain weren't always the best, and again, you know, because they were away from their parents, could dish out, you know, not the most appropriate punishments.
You know, for a while, I think there was like a spate of movies that came out specifically about that, even in America, too. I am a former Catholic school student, so the history there is not exactly great, but you're exactly right. It does kind of romanticize something that is usually depicted quite the opposite. I was, for some reason, and maybe it's just because I finished The Wife Upstairs, I'm thinking about Jane Eyre and, you know, the kind of the school that she's in. I know that's not a boarding school, but some, you're exactly right. Some of these things, like, I mean, God, I hope it didn't get as intense as Filch is talking about, but I know there's some pretty terrible history.
Jess and I had a certain someone as a teacher who grew up in that type of environment. He was one of our writing teachers, and he, his parents literally sent him to one of those. And the few stories that he mentioned of those, yeah, it was pretty brutal in a sense. Like, it was not a good environment in certain instances.
So they feel a little bit better because they're going to spend their detention with Hagrid. And so they think, okay, this can't possibly be that bad, right? But then they're going into the forest. And for once, I agree 100% with Draco Malfoy.
Yes. Yeah. I also thought, like, okay, I know they're excited to see Hagrid, but, like, what does Hagrid most commonly deal with? Like,
You just dealt with him messing around with a dragon. Like, there's probably some sort of creature involved that you may not have, like, the education yet to him.
So when Malfoy is adamantly against it, I think I agree with him as well.
Yeah, I'm not going into that forest, he said. You are if you want to stay at Hogwarts, said Hagrid fiercely. You've done wrong, and now you've got to pay for it. But this is servant stuff. It's not for students to do. I thought we'd be copying lines or something. If my father knew I was doing this, he'd tell you that's how it is at Hogwarts, Hagrid growled. Copying lines. What's good that to anyone? You'll do something useful or you'll get out.
And here was the opportunity again for Malfoy to throw around that he's got money with the, but this is servant stuff.
Yeah, daddy's not gonna save you this time, you know, like, yeah, it is funny that I'm like, you know, you're like, oh hey, yeah, well, you're at a magic school, yes, but yes, your punishment is going to be mortal danger, and if you make it, you make it, and if you don't, well, nobody's gonna know you're gone because we have magic. Like that's kind of grim, but it's like, it's pretty dark chapter, you know, so it's like, it's like, yeah, the Forbidden Forest, you know, like, we shouldn't go in there, right? No, oh, Forbidden, that's just a name. It's actually very pretty, you know, like, I don't know. It seems kind of funny that they're sending
with
these
fairies and magic toadstools.
Yeah.
And unicorns.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And centaurs and all sorts of, you know, beasts that they bring up in there.
When I read this chapter, okay, there's another Harry Potter podcast called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. It's very good. And one of my favorite ongoing jokes in that podcast is their failed pedagogy of Hogwarts, which again talks about all the times they put the students in mortal danger.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so I always go back to this one as, again, Jess and I in previous episode, we've had several conversations about how much physical pain or danger can these kids withstand, probably more so than we could because they're wizards and they can heal things much more quickly than they could with non-magical people, with us. And so in that sense, I look at least the books in the series when they're like older and teenagers, I tend to be like, okay. And I'm also just one of those people who likes to try and give, you know, teenagers adult responsibility when it's appropriate. But this one, I always come back to, again, as the worst example of failed pedagogy at Hogwarts, that, okay, they're gonna go track down a unicorn who has been injured. Hagrid states that it's very hard to catch a unicorn. Not even a werewolf can catch a unicorn. And we're gonna go find and see what killed it.
Yeah, this is quite the I mean, I didn't know how difficult it was to hurt a unicorn, but they really kind of upped the ante throughout, you know, their pursuit of this unicorn and how, like, diabolical this whatever has to be to harm the unicorn itself. So let's just send a bunch of kids out to try to figure this out. That's a little intense. My parents would write a letter.
Yeah, the absolute youngest students at the school. Right. Let's throw them in the forest to catch the unicorn killer.
Yeah, yeah, now, and it's like not even your. Well, I mean, like, we find out later, right? Like that, like Hermione gets like 100 and something on one of her tests, and it's like, okay, she is one of the highest IQ or best test takers in the class. Like, so you're not just sacrificing students, but you're basically sacrificing some of your better ones, like, too. Like, if, you know, if there were a few people that didn't come to class, you know, 10 times in a row or something, and you're like, oh, hey, go do that. If we lose you, it's no big loss. You know, I could kind of somewhat understand that.
I really hope your students aren't listening, Morgan.
me too.
Hang them by the ceiling, throw them to werewolf killers.
So I really wanted to ask you all this question, and maybe Amy, you're gonna ask it, and I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I don't really know a lot of, like, unicorn mythology. I mean, I know it's like very popular thing right now, but is there any sort of, do you all have any sort of, like, background on this mythical creature specifically?
There's a bunch of it in, like, Roman stuff. It's not even like really mythical based. It's like, there's like records of like them seeing, like, apparently there was like a kind of stag that supposedly only had like one horn, and they're like, they would record that they had seen this kind of stag with one projected horn, and they think that might be something to go with the actual unicorn type of stuff. But I mean, the only basis I have with the unicorn mythology type of stuff is like, you know, your standard fantasy thing, like you know, like the horn or the blood is supposed to be able to heal, and I guess again, that's the other thing is that it's supposed to be impossible to catch a unicorn. That's the other trope that I know about it. But anyway, yeah, that the unicorn itself, not much in the mythology aspect do I know much in there. So
yeah, so the unicorn, it's always been associated with purity, and by extension, Christ in some capacities. And also, again, the mythology that only women can even possibly, like, tempt a unicorn, like, and get close to it.
Whoa, that's cool. I didn't know.
Yep. And then, so, yeah, with the unicorn, it's just been a long-standing symbol for purity. And, again, going off what Morgan said, like, I've looked at histories of unicorns. My personal theory is that, like, in the Middle East and Central Asia and stuff like that, people said they saw this horse with one horn. And honestly, I think it's more they saw something akin to a rhino.
Yeah, I read
because,
that too.
Yeah, because the, like, take Persian, for example. Persian, the word for horse is asb. But the word for hippo in Persian is asbe abi, literally water horse. So in a way, in some of those languages where these quote-unquote unicorns were being cited, like, their word for horse was a very generic word for four-legged animal.
Okay.
And so I feel like, you know, when it finally got translated into other languages, it, you know, we forget about that generalization of that word. And so it came to be like a horse with, you know, the one horn.
Yeah. And actually this kind of makes me kind of fall in line with you a little bit is, The only other thing I know, and it's interesting with you mentioning the female aspect with a unicorn, is that I've read somewhere, and this is a while ago, that the unicorn is traditionally it's the female type of that. The alicorn is the male type, supposedly, like that in certain things that I've seen anyway, like. That I read it somewhere years ago in one of my mythology classes, and I don't remember where, but that alicorn was supposedly like the male version of that. But it kind of goes hand in hand with what you were saying with the as, but like that a emphasis. I don't know. Maybe that has something to do with it too.
Yep. So yeah, they're looking at branches again, silver blood everywhere. And again, could a werewolf be killing the unicorns? Harry asked. Not fast enough, said Hagrid. It's not easy to catch a unicorn. They're powerful magical creatures. I never knew one to be hurt before. And this, okay, so this makes me wonder about, you know, we don't really know the exact borders of the Forbidden Forest or, like, if there's any. Like, I'm just wondering about the dynamic of Hagrid seems so sure that there's nothing in the forest that'll hurt you if you're with me. So he's kind of operating on under the assumption that nothing could have possibly gotten into the forest, that he, a creature that he doesn't already know about. And I'm just wondering, you know, just what are the nature of the physical or magical protections on the forest, and how far does the forest extend, and when did those, when does that border begin and end, and could something get into the forest that Hagrid may not know about?
It's, sure seems that way. I'm looking at a little depiction. That would be interesting to know. Where does it, I mean, it kind of can see where it starts. It's got the wounded. I mean, I'm just getting a feel for Hogwarts and its property here. But I don't know, because how would he really know? I mean, that's, he's kind of like, you know, having some bravado there. That's like, oh, there's nothing I can't handle. Obviously there is. I mean, like, he's a little overconfident in this scenario.
Yeah, if nothing will harm you, then why the hell do you have a crossbow, Hagrid?
It's like erect a big sign there. It says, now entering Forbidden Forest. Like, here, kids, don't go past that sign. Like, you'd think there would be one.
Well, they're, and that's the thing. They're not supposed to go in there. And then they're being told to go in there because at the Quidditch match, what isn't that where Quirrell and Snape had their little conversation? Because Harry kind of like crept around and listened to that. Or am I remembering that wrong?
No, no, that's right.
Okay. I remembered something. There's no. Well, so, okay, there isn't a werewolf, but we do get to meet a centaur, which is pretty cool.
Yes. And so, yeah, like, and it's so funny that, you know, we're introduced to the first centaur who is called Ronan. And then, like, a page or so later, the book just says, and a second centaur came out. It's okay. So we established, let's just forget the incredulity that I'm seeing a centaur for the first time. Here's another one.
Yeah, they're just kind of like popping out everywhere, it seemed like, there for a minute. I don't know anything about centaurs other than, like, you know, just kind of seeing them depicted. I think James McAvoy is, isn't he a centaur? Or maybe,
he's a puck in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe.
There we go. Okay.
Or Fawn. Don't confuse those two.
Yes, I know. I was like, oh, shit, I just made a fatal mistake. Mythology.
Shame.
What's that?
Shame.
We're leaking our Game of Thrones in here, yep. Amy. So I thought it was pretty funny because they're talking about, like, Mars is bright tonight. They say that Ronan says that about 50 times. Not really. He says it, you know, a couple of times. And Hagrid says, you know, centaurs, like, flipping stargazers or something like that. So, again, I wondered if there's any sort of, like, mythology to that. Yeah, as I mean, well.
The Greek mythology is like, I think, probably the progenitor of that. That's the only ones that I've come across a lot of that in there was when we were, when I was in school, when in our mythology class, Jess. But Ovid's Metamorphoses, they appear in. And, I mean, traditionally, the centaur, they're like if you're looking at, like, well-known centaurs, like, she uses the name Ronan. There's Chiron, the centaur in Greek mythology, who teaches a number of Greek heroes in the ways of, like, war and fighting and all sorts of other stuff. Like Jason and the Argonauts, Jason himself, is taught by a centaur. And it's even mentioned that Achilles might've been taught by a centaur. But Chiron, I find it like an interesting, like, mix of Ronan and Chiron kind of have a last suffix there. But Chiron was a son of a Titan. So he was a half brother to Zeus himself. So, but Chiron gets wounded by Hercules in Greek mythology with an arrow not unicorn blood, but Hydra blood. Mm. And the wound will never heal after that. And so there's an interesting dichotomy that where we have, like, the unicorn blood where it mentions it's, like, you know, it has healing properties, but, and then we have the centaurs that, I mean, she doesn't get into any of that Greek stuff with wounds really, but it is also interesting too, if you look at, like, constellations in so many Greek based constellations, that they're looking at the stars, right? And Hagrid's like, does he call them stargazers? Is that what you said, Jess?
I think that's what he calls it. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the basic stuff of centaurs anyway, that I remember anyway.
I'm not as knowledgeable with centaurs as with unicorns, but yeah, centaurs classic in Greek mythology. Didn't know that they had a huge, you know, affiliation with astronomy or astrology in their culture in the Greek canon. But yeah, so we've got two centaurs who are saying, you know, Mars is bright tonight, and so they trot along, and then someone has sent up red sparks, the other group with Draco and Neville, and so Hagrid runs off to go save them from whatever, and of course it's Draco just being a dick.
Yeah, which, like, what a time to be an asshole. I mean, he's an asshole all the time, so I guess you just can't turn that.
I don't know. Like, for as logical as Draco was about this whole enterprise of the forest, you would think he could have turned it off for at least the few hours they were in the forest.
One would think. Yes, I agree. That he just kind of he wants to, like, rile Neville up, right? So he just is being a jerk. But But that leads us to the sad part.
Yeah, so it gets to a point where, you know, Hagrid's mad at Draco, so he's like, Harry, go with Draco. I'm really sorry, but, you know, you won't be as easily scared. Which, again, reminded me of that instance where Morgan, I've mentioned before, there was a kid who would mockingly refer to me as Hermione in fifth grade.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Again, I was put next to him because the teacher knew I could manage him. And I got to a point where it's not my job to manage him. Put him somewhere else.
Right.
So Harry and Draco are walking along, and Jess, what do they find?
They see the poor unicorn. There were splashes. Harry thought the blood seemed to get thicker. There were splashes on the roots of the tree as though the poor creature had been thrashing around in pain close by. Harry could see a clearing ahead. This was the part that I stood out to me. Harry had never seen anything so beautiful and sad.
Mm-hmm. And so they find the dead unicorn, but what else do they find?
Oh yeah, there's like somebody lurking around, which we are led to believe that is... Can we say the name on this podcast? I don't know. We haven't had to yet. Voldemort, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. I didn't know if that like that was like a... I don't know the rules, basically. Do we say who shall not be named? Or
yes, we as readers can say the name, Jess.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I know the fandoms can get pretty intense, so...
Yeah. Well, that's one of the good things about Harry Potter fandom. They're not crazy like that.
Okay. There are others that I have encountered.
Star Wars, I know. So, yeah, Malfoy just totally screams and bolts and leaves Harry to the mercy of this slithering Satan.
Yeah. Harry starts having this like excruciating pain, which is going to be happening quite often whenever he's in that presence. It's that the pain in Harry's head was so bad he fell to his knees. It took a minute or two to pass.
Mm-hmm.
So then he looked up and the centaurs.
Yeah, so this is the nicer centaur. This is Firenze.
I'm so glad you said that name because I was like, Firenze? Like, what are we saying here? So thank you.
Firenze.
He is young and has astonishing blue eyes.
That's funny because I remember that part where he comes in. One of the other people that in mythology that is trained by a centaur is Asclepius, who's a healer in Greek mythology. It's actually kind of funny, I guess, that that, you know, we have a good centaur that's, you know, taking care of Harry. It's a distant comparison there, but I figured I'd mention it.
I think it makes sense, like the healing friend.
Yep. And so Firenze offers to like have Harry ride him to quickly reunite him with Hagrid. But then he's confronted by Bane and Ronan. And Ronan, and they're not happy with him.
So, I probably got way too caught up in my head about, like, how this would look. Like, where would you put your hands? You know, like, I was thinking way too deep into it. But, yeah, they yell at him. He said, what are you doing? You have a human on your back. Have you no shame? Are you a common mule? Like, whoa. It's just trying to help somebody out.
Yeah.
Apparently that's bad form.
Yes, it's also the accusation of Harry riding him, but also, did you tell him anything? Like, you know, it's not our, we just observe the stars, it's not our place to interfere with whatever like that. And Firenze's just like, you know, this is the Potter boy, this is really important, like, we have bigger fish to fry, and I will help humans if I have to.
They are very concerned about the stars, and I got very, again, those are another thing I got caught up in. And, you know, I read my horoscope. I know my sun, moon, rising, things like that. So I kind of thought a little bit about some of that. They were saying they don't interfere with the, you know, what the planets have said. And I guess they're not sharing that information specifically. But I really, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Amy, but I thought about you and some of your background, especially, I mean, I think Mars is the, you know, God of War, is that right?
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just like to make sure. Some of this I was wondering, it was kind of like, to me, that was just foreshadowing of this showdown that we all know is coming, you know, between good and evil, basically. But anything beyond that, I kind of was curious your take and Morgan's take on this little incident.
Yeah, well, for me with this incident, yeah, of course, it is definitely foreshadowing with Mars being the Roman version of Ares, God of War. And why what I took out of this interaction between Frenzy and the other centaurs, it reminded me of my brief stint as a grant writer for that nonprofit that helped Native American communities.
Oh.
Like, I'm sure I'm not the first to, like, you know, think of the metaphor of the centaurs with indigenous peoples, but I'm doing it not so much because of the physicality of them living in the forest and clearly being very close to nature and stuff like that. I draw upon that mostly by their attitudes towards their knowledge of, like, astronomy and astrology, and the fact that they want to guard that knowledge. They guard that knowledge so jealously, which makes sense. And I'm sure that this has happened in a variety of ways in many tribes between the older generation and the younger generation of indigenous peoples and modern tribes, trying to figure out what do we want to share, what do we want to keep. One example is, so one of the tribes we helped was the Pueblo of Acoma, which is a tribe in New Mexico in the Southwest. And it was, when we first started working with them, it was such an achievement because for so long the Pueblo of Acoma had considered, like, their language sacred, and the leadership was such that they believed that to write down their language or to share their language with the outside world would take away its sacredness. And only finally it got to the point where leadership changed and they finally accepted, okay, we're really gonna, like, lose our language if we don't do something. And so it was a huge breakthrough that they were willing to work with us. And so I thought of the same thing of, you know, we don't know exactly what the nature of relations are between wizards and centaurs, but clearly they're in a position where they've probably been exploited in the past and they don't want to be further exploited. So they take very extreme measures to guard against any sort of human infiltration, even if it's just, you know, again, Frenzy's just trying to help out a little kid.
I'm glad you brought that up, Amy. And I think it was interesting, too. They know who Harry is, too. That I thought that I was kind of thought for a little bit, like, maybe they don't know who this guy is. But there was said, you're the Potter boy. It's Harry Potter. Like, we got to help this guy out. So the quicker he leaves the forest, the better. So I didn't, you know, kind of based on what you're saying, is it if he acquires too much knowledge or just for his safety? I guess they know, you know, they know that this guy's coming out from what I can assess.
Morgan, any thoughts?
Oh, well, I was just going to add, I don't think you're that far off with the Native American comparison with the centaur, because in Ovid, that it says that they're a tribe. I remember that being the case. I ended up having to look this up, but the tribe of centaurs that they run into is called the Centauri, and they are it literally says Thessalian tribe of half horsemen. So, and then you get the Sagittarius tie-in where they're archers. They hunt with bows. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think that's far off at all. I think it's right on the money.
My moon sign is Sagittarius.
Really? I'm Cancer. I'm all water.
Yeah.
I don't
know. Which I'm really surprised that my moon sign was a fire sign, because I'm Mar with earth and water. But anyway.
I don't know what
Morgan's a Scorpio. Your sun sign is Scorpio. We know. I know that.
Yes. Yes. I don't know how that relates to my moon sign. Like, yeah.
We'll have to do your chart sometime.
Okay. All right.
And then, so I really like, as they leave the centaurs and Frenzy is bringing Harry back to Hagrid, I love Frenzy posing the questions. He's very Socratic in trying to get Harry to figure it out for himself.
Yeah, he was the, I don't know, I liked him as well. I'm trying to find the questions. I'm just to the point where they're sauntering out of the forest and he's talking about what a horrible thing it is to slay a unicorn, and kind of goes into some detail about, you know, only one with nothing to lose and everything to gain would commit such a crime. And that just kind of made me think of what would the real world equivalent of that be. But
interesting. What is the real world equivalent, Morgan?
I was listening to Jess there trying to think of something, and I don't know. I'm drawing a blank.
Okay. The only thing I think of is that person who presses the button for the nuclear warhead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's a good point. There's a really great documentary on it's been in the news, so you guys might have heard of it. I cannot remember the year, but I think it was during the height of the Cold War. But there was a Russian guy that was he was one of the guys at the helm of launching a nuclear missile. And there was some malfunction or something where it's said essentially you need to hit the button, and he didn't. and it basically prevented a all-out nuclear war. I cannot remember his name, but
I don't know the details of that story, but you're absolutely right. I am aware that a lot of people don't really, really know just how close we were to nuclear war.
Yeah, but that's a good analogy for that, though. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And then Harry is reunited with Hagrid, and, you know, they go back up to the castle, and, you know, Harry's freaking out because it's like, oh no, it's like Snape doesn't just want this for himself. Snape is trying to get it for Voldemort. Dun, dun, dun.
Right.
All I thought about the entire time with the unicorns was the movie Legend with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry. That's the only thing I was basically thinking about the whole time I read about the unicorns.
Yep, and then the chapter ends with someone was really nice and picked up Harry's invisibility cloak and gave it back to him.
Tried to guess who this was, couldn't come up with it. I don't think it was McGonagall, but maybe it was probably Dumbledore. I don't know.
Yeah, when Harry pulled back his sheets, he found his invisibility cloak folded neatly underneath them. There was a note pinned to it, just in case.
How lovely.
Yeah.
Well, the invisibility cloak would have been really nice in the scary forest.
Yeah, they probably could have got a little closer to probably Voldemort in the unicorn.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, you could have snuck up on him while he's weak and just buried him out in the forest once you've taken care of him, and then there wouldn't be six more books or however many more books.
I was going to say, there's our fanfic. Like, Voldemort right. is destroyed in the initial, like, in the initial book.
Harry Potter, the kids in a shovel, took care of him.
Chapter 16, Through the Trapdoor. In the years to come, Harry would never quite remember how he managed to get through his exams when he half expected Voldemort to come bursting through the door at any moment. Like, again, Harry's having a very strong reaction to, again, well, first of all, because he's the one who witnessed Voldemort in the forest, and he's the one with the history with Voldemort, and just physically seeing this apparition or manifestation of Voldemort has just made it all the more real to him. And even, and everyone saying, like, Hagrid saying, like, no one really thinks that he died. He's just, like, biding his time. And so he's freaking out, and I don't know how he's being able to take his exams.
I think about how I handle stress, and I don't know if I would be able to handle those two things very well at all.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If I were at a wizard school and there was like threat of death, like, I'm sorry, my concerns are going to go toward threat of death and not my new alchemy test or whatever. Like, right. Like, I'm going to be researching spells that can take my enemy out in one shot.
Right.
So they have all their exams, and one thing I thought of, just the throwaway, their very last exam was History of Magic, and I'm just so sad because History of Magic sounds like it could be so much fun, and the ghost Professor Binns makes it so boring.
Man, I feel like that's how I had history teachers in high school. It was just like this, I took in college, I had a history class, which I loved, and because it was a bit more about the people of, you know, the society at the time rather than the wars and the people that fought them. Which is not really interesting to me. So I can relate to the boring history teacher. He wasn't a ghost. He was just a guy who'd been a teacher too long and he was ready to retire. That was my boring history teacher.
I don't know. It's just like the way that, again, to go back to Game of Thrones again. Sorry, Jess.
No, that's, I love
it. Well, it's just the idea that how popular Game of Thrones is. And in terms of, in the grand scheme of things, the level of magic in Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire is kind of low compared to other high fantasy stories. And the idea is that I believe I heard that J.R.R. Martin, like, again, a lot of his stuff is based off the War of the Roses. But he didn't but if he was going to go do historical fiction, he would have wanted to, like, accurately portray exactly what happened. So to give himself the creative license, like, it's not like he's, like, going to write a story with real historical characters that of things that didn't happen, like the other Boleyn girl or something like that. So part of it, of creating his world, was to give himself the creative license to do that. But all the basis is in War of the Roses. And so if people love this sort of blood, death, political intrigue, incest. Like, you can read that in history books.
You're spot on. I mean, like, there's some pretty dark stuff. I knew that was kind of where he took some of his kind of outline, or I guess, for lack of a better term, for Game of Thrones. And I knew it was pretty bleak. Morgan, are you, have you read the Game of Thrones books.
I read the first one. Yeah. And, you know, sadly, history itself doesn't have Amelia Clark in it. And so it's not as interesting. That was a terrible joke. But the first book, like, I didn't read the rest of them. And that's more because kind of what Amy said, like, it's very about intrigue and it's very long-winded and there's very subtle magic, if any magic. There's hardly any in a sense. And so when I was getting into that type of stuff, it was more of like a Terry Goodkind, like Sword of Truth series, where you kind of get the same long-winded nature, but there's a lot more magic and there's a lot more people dying. like I'm not sure what else to mention, I guess, in regards to the whole Game of Thrones thing. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Well, again, just the idea that, again, Jess and I were talking about this in other episodes, if only students were allowed to research subjects or like research aspects of history that they enjoyed, and maybe school wouldn't have such a bad rep.
Totally. The history of magic, I agree with you, though. It sounds awesome. Like, really? Maybe I'll find some old tome that has a spell that nobody's found before, and I hopefully it won't backfire on me. Like it sounds like a cool class that yeah, if you have a bad teacher for something even you enjoy greatly, it can really, really kill it for you.
I mean, I've had that happen. I remember that happening when I went to college. So one bad teacher spoils the whole subject matter. I don't
Me
know.
Too, yep.
And then so they kind of finish up their exams. And then Harry finally puts the pieces together of why is it that Hagrid's greatest desire is to have a dragon's egg? And someone just happens to show up in the village with one? And so Harry finally puts it together that it was intentional for Hagrid to acquire Norbert because this mysterious stranger who he played with and convinced him, oh yeah, I can take care of a dragon because I deal with the three-headed Cerberus. And that's, you know, that's easy. And, you know, just the fact that he was so drunk that he spilled the beans on just play some music and Fluffy falls asleep.
I hate people like that, but I, you know, just taking advantage of situations, I guess. I don't know, because I feel like I'm always so honest and can't see through things like that. I probably shouldn't share that out to the world. But good on Harry for figuring that out. So I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, it's just like, again, Dumbledore, McGonagall's right. You cannot trust Hagrid with secrets. Like, if you want to use him to transport the Philosopher's Stone, fine, but don't give him any other duties associated with the stone.
I know some people like that. It's just like, don't tell them anything you don't want repeated. Do the thing and carry on. But
yeah, what is it? Two can keep a secret if one of them is dead or something like that.
I've never heard that, but dang, that's pretty. I guess that's true. I guess.
And so Harry deduces that it must have been Snape who had the dragon egg and got Hagrid drunk and, you know, got Hagrid to tell him, and so that he's going to try and steal a stone. So they want to go to Dumbledore. And they run into McGonagall, and she said, like, Dumbledore's not here. He left for the Ministry of Magic. And he's like, no, it's important. And McGonagall's like, Professor Dumbledore is the most, like, prominent wizard of the 20th century. Of course the Ministry calls him from time to time.
Yeah, she was like, she really, like, kind of put them in their place a little bit. I mean, granted, what they have to talk about is important, but she was like, y'all, just stop it, you know, for 5 seconds. The world does not revolve around you. It was kind of like one of those conversations with the
Yeah, and so they try to tell her it's about the stone. Someone's trying to steal it. And I'm a little frustrated with McGonagall in this moment because it's just showing, like, why, I don't know, how do I put it? It's just, I'm disappointed that she doesn't hear them out more, especially when she now realizes they have a very crucial piece of information that first year students should not have.
Yeah, because she's taken aback by that. Like, how do you all know this? And then, but still shut up and go to bed or whatever. That's basically what
happened. You know what this reminds, again, Game of Thrones. This reminds me of right where I am in Game of Thrones is when Arya Stark overhears, like, Varys and another guy talking about the plot against whoever, and she tries to tell her dad, And, you know, her dad doesn't believe her, even though she gives specific details of things that he's been investigating, like Robert's bastards and finding Gendry. And still he's just like, oh, whatever, kids are full of shit. And it's like, no, she mentioned two pertinent details that you're already on the trail of. Why didn't you listen to her? You deserve to be beheaded.
I was going to say the same thing. It's like, that guy deserved, like, everything he got because he's too stupid to live.
Ned? Like, Ned Stark?
Ned, yeah. Like,
okay.
Like, for a dude that is you know, he's in command of an entire house, and, like, not to mention, yeah, his daughter spills the beans. Like, you're already, your mind's already acute on this investigation, and you get details about the investigation, and I'm sorry, I'm gonna be like, wait, go back to that. Did I just hear what I heard, thought I heard? Like, I'm going to be hyper aware of anything that has their name in it, right? Like, or whoever I'm searching for. So that's kind of the thing about Harry Potter, like, in the scope of this novel or any of it, is I'm like, man, the teachers at this school, for being great magicians, they are incredibly stupid. Like, I don't know.
So there's something to be said of when you have magic, how, you know, to take care of your life and stuff, then how much do you have to, like, challenge yourself intellectually? Like,
that's true, right?
Which we see in Snape's contribution through the trapdoor.
Mm-hmm. What is it? And they run into that puzzle there, down there, that's the logic-based, and they mention that, like, the wizards can't think logically.
Yeah, like, Hermione says something to that effect, and again, in the sense that their magical ability spoils them in certain regards, so they don't have to be as innovative as Muggles.
Whew, there's some hard truths for the witches and wizards there.
But yeah, so McGonagall, again, very disappointed that she doesn't listen to them, doesn't even try to hear them out or reassure them in a, like, nice way, just a very, like, you know, I'm the adult, do what I say, or otherwise I'll take even more points from Gryffindor.
Oh my god, she's
is
like
it possible to get negative points in this school?
Yeah.
That's a story, like, I want to hear about. It's just the school that got negative points one year.
Like, because the points are shown in, like, these gems in hourglass. Like, do they just go upside down? Or, like, I don't know, do you flip the hourglass over? I don't know. But then they get to a point where Harry's like, okay, Dumbledore's gone. Snape's going to make his move tonight, and I'm going to go follow him. And Ron and Hermione first try to convince him not to, but he's like, you can't, said Hermione. After what McGonagall and Snape have said, you'll be expelled. So what? Harry shouted. Don't you understand? If Snape gets hold of the stone, Voldemort's coming back. Haven't you heard what it was like when he was trying to take over? There won't be any Hogwarts to get expelled from. So, yeah, Harry understands the scope of this much more than they do at this point.
He kind of loses his shit here, too. Like, I'm never going over to the dark side. I'm going through that trapdoor tonight, and nothing you two say is going to stop me. Voldemort killed my parents, remember? It's like, okay, we get it. Like, he just really got super, I guess I can't blame him, but he got super, super pissed.
Yeah, I was kind of, like, surprised at that part, too. I was like, hey, man, I was like, little old Daniel didn't convey this level of rage very well from the book. I'm like, I'm liking this Harry Potter. Let's go get some good old John Wick vengeance. Like,
this is like, that is something, I think that's a good point for, like, somebody who's seen the movies versus, like, for myself versus in the books. It's, he is definitely more, like, striking and witty and, you know, volatile than I remember him being in the movie.
Me too. I was kind of surprised. I was like, wow, okay, for a, you know, I don't know how old he's supposed to be here, but like, I mean, for that level of kid, he's like, wow, that part, he's doing the I'm gonna go get some vengeance speech here, you know, like, yeah, I was behind it there.
So again, they get their invisible cloak, they're about to sneak out. But then they get confronted by Neville. Poor Neville.
Poor Neville. Sorry. And then just kind of binds him.
The honeydew. Yep.
Yeah. The poor honeydew.
That poor kid.
Yeah. What have you done to him? It's the full body bind. Oh, Neville, I'm so sorry. So yeah, so Harry brings his flute and he plays it so that Fluffy goes to sleep.
Glad he got that flute. That was a Christmas present.
From Hagrid.
I was going to say, only if he was playing Jethro Tull on his flute, you know? Like, like, yeah, that was a terrible joke. And
no.
Yep. And they open the trap door and they can't see anything. It's just pitch black.
Right. And is this where they encounter, this is where they come up with the little scheme to be the Bloody Baron. Is that right? Or
oh no, that was before. That was like before. They ran into Peeves.
Yes. Yes. Okay, good. Cause I don't.
Yeah. They ran into Peeves before getting to Fluffy, and Peeves is like, I can sense you even if I don't see you. And Harry pretends to be the Bloody Baron.
Yes, this is the plant, right? The like crazy, maybe snake-like plant.
Peeves? No.
No, 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 no. Like where we are now. So we get past Peeves. We're past Fluffy.
Yeah, past Peeves, past Fluffy. They all jump down and we get to the plant.
Yes. Okay. Not okay. A snake.
Yeah, not a snake, but plants are pretty violent in this series.
Yeah.
They seem to have a vendetta versus versus anything.
What did you think of this first challenge, Morgan?
I like it. It's so a recurring theme. And like I said, I hadn't read all of the books or anything like that. Like, but I know came through in the movies because I can see some of it here is I really like that they use Hermione in the way they do. Like she's kind of the fountain of knowledge. Like she basically smarter than everyone that I've encountered so far. She's pretty much the only competent one. I mean, Harry has his moments, but I think, you know, if I was going to keep reading these books, this book or any of the others, I'd start making a tally of how many times Harry or Ron would be dead without Hermione. And I think that the tally mark would not be short there. Like, and so she just, you can't even really say Harry's the brawn and she's the brains because, and then Ron would be the fool, but you can't even really say that because she's kind of both, to be honest. I don't know. I like this part because it does show, again, her aptitude for everything.
And I like it because it shows both her strength and also a weakness of hers, that the reason she prepares so well and memorizes everything is that she probably knows on a certain level she's not the greatest under pressure, so she always wants to be prepared.
That's good. Yeah, it's good.
And so she at first, like, she literally, you know, in the mortal peril situation, she literally forgets that she's a witch because, again, she's only known she's been a witch for a year.
Right. I love that. Ron calls her out. Have you gone mad? Are you a witch or not? And she's like, oh, right.
And one thing I will say is definitely this is a bonus episode I might want to do later is the four Hogwarts houses are associated with four of the Greek elements, water, fire, earth, and air. And so, you know, this dangerous plant was the spell or contribution of Professor Sprout, who is the head of Hufflepuff House, and the element of the Hufflepuff House is, of course, Earth.
Mm. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. What the Gryffindor one was then? If Harry is it? I assume it's not fire, but maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, it is.
It is fire. Okay. That tracks actually. Then okay, interesting.
Okay. Yeah. So then the next challenge is the flying keys.
This was pretty cool. I thought this was. Yeah. I just envisioned it, like being around it, and I thought it was cool to see.
I think one thing I forgot about is that in the book, the wings of the keys are feathers, whereas in the movies, it was more like dragonfly insect wings.
Oh.
Huh.
Yeah. They talk about jewel bright birds. It was full of small jewel bright birds fluttering, tumbling all over the room. So I just imagined all the like different birds and beautiful feathers, what I in my mind's eye.
Me too. I saw the same thing, like with because it mentions, was it the one, is its feathers were messed up or something with the wing was bent or something. So that's how I knew. But yeah, I have, like I said, I've only seen the movies, like you said, Amy. Like when I was reading this, I was like, I couldn't remember what the wings were like in the movie, but I was sure they did not look like this.
And of course, and this was the charm that was contributed by Professor Flitwick, head of Ravenclaw. And the element of Ravenclaw is?
I'm guessing air, if it's the
air. Bird.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Does Slytherin's water?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is kind of an interesting choice in the case that typically, really, when you get into like an elemental nature in anything magic based, what's usually the bad guy? Usually the bad guy's fire. Like that's usually the you know, you look at a lot of those old movies or books, and fire's the one that the enemy uses because it's the most powerful, but it's uncontrollable. It's chaos, you know? And that's why when you said that the Gryffindor one was actually fire, I was kind of surprised. That's interesting.
Yes, I've actually brought that up in some other podcasts where I don't know how I got on the tangent of Harry Potter, but I did bring that up because things like Avatar The Last Airbender, bad guys are fire.
Fire, that's right.
Yeah, the idea of fire being the good guys, it's kind of not as common in modern day stuff. But anyway, so after keys is the chessboard, which is Professor McGonagall's contribution.
I love this part. It's so good.
Yeah. And again, Gryffindor's element is fire. So I sort of interpret this as, you know, the fire and heat of battle, if you will, represented via the chessmen.
That's such a good part. Like, I actually, well, so again, me having only seen the movies, I got to this part and I'm like, ooh, I remember this part from the movie. That was one of the few parts from the first movie that I like, oh, I would genuinely go back and watch that scene. I like that scene. And I was surprised at how quick they were through it. Like, I'm like, man, I really wanted more of this. Like, I don't know. The imagery in it's really good. And even like what they pick of as their pieces. And I don't know. It was just really interesting and really neat that the nature of having to do this big chess game and stuff. So
I love that it gave Ron the opportunity to kind of like flex his you know, skills too, because this is something that Hermione and Harry were not as great at, but he kind of was like, okay, I've got this. And I appreciated that, because I feel like he's kind of overshadowed sometimes. We've talked about Ron and his abilities are under, you know, sometimes he's what's the word I'm looking for, he's kind of
incapable.
Well, maybe
the honeydew when Neville's not there.
underestimated is what I was going to say. But so I appreciated it was his moment to kind of show off here. I thought that was
yeah. Well, and Amy, you're gonna have to remind me of this, because I think I remember it right. Doesn't he choose a paladin as his piece?
Yeah, he's the knight.
Okay, he's the knight. Yeah, paladin knight. Yeah, it's interesting, like, because like the imagery's great. Like, you know, okay, yeah, he's the knight. You know, the knight's the, you know, the symbol of battle. But it is also interesting that Rowling picked him to pick the knight, which I feel like she probably did it for the imagery and the symbolism behind it. But if I was going to pick a piece on a chessboard to stand on, I would not pick the knight. like you know, they're very limited in their movement, and it's interesting, like. The nature, like, I'd go stand on that queen and I can move anywhere on the board I want. And yeah, I don't know. It makes me overanalyze that scene a lot, being a chess lover, but
oh, wow.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not a chess lover, but I forgot to mention Morgan, because we want to give as little attention to She Who Must Not Be Named and her transphobic ways. We are going through the series under the premise that Harry wrote them as memoirs later in life.
Oh, okay. All right.
Morgan, I didn't know you liked chess, because like when you were talking about the knight and things like that, I was like, well, I know more about chess than I did like ever in my life. I've never played chess. I watched The Queen's Gambit, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest chess fan either. Like, I prefer card games over like those board games.
It's so, just something my grandpa, when I was young, we started me young playing it. And I have not played in a long time now, despite loving the game. But yeah, I always really enjoyed it.
And Ron gets to be the hero and sacrifices himself. And literally, the queen just whacks him on the head. Like, she could have killed him.
I know, that was pretty intense. But like, you know, here we don't care about kids' lives, basically.
Harry and Hermione are like, oh, we can lose Ron. He doesn't really do anything.
We've got Neville.
Yeah, we've got Neville as a backup, right?
Exactly. Yeah, well, I think it just says something again about how Ron good is at chess. Because again, this is McGonagall's contribution. And so I have it in my headcanon that she could only transfigure this chess board to play against the intruders to her level of intelligence. So I'm inferring from this whole exercise is that Ron can basically beat McGonagall at chess.
Yeah, that's something I thought about as well. It had to be like a certain level. And again, like I said, I watched The Queen's Gambit, and I know chess is can be very, very difficult. And I was kind of like, this was a level that at least the kids could play. So
And it also, it brings into question, though, like the level of your security traps when a bunch of freshman kids can beat him, you know, like no magic. They're just outsmarting everything, you know, it's kind of funny. Like it shows, like you, what you said, Amy, like these wizards are too reliant on magic to realize common sense.
So only Harry and Hermione go on because Ron's knocked out cold. And okay, and then they get past one Quirrell's challenge, but it's a troll and it's already been knocked out.
That kind of threw me for a little bit of a loop because I'm not going to overthink, but somebody, I don't know how that happened. I don't know how that happened.
And then finally we get Snape's contribution, which again, Snape is head of Slytherin House and he's the potions master, and the element of Slytherin is
water. Weird.
What we kind of touched upon before is that Snape's contribution is much more rooted in logic than actual magic, and Hermione makes note of this. And I think it's also, again, wizard trivia, like Snape is a half-blood, so one of his parents is a muggle, so I think it says a lot about him that he had at least had one muggle parent, and therefore he thinks about these things and isn't as, you know, dumb and magically reliant as maybe some pureblood wizards.
Okay.
I didn't know that yeah. His parents were half and half.
He gives this little riddle of, like, you know, the typical, like, you know, pick, what was it the pirates do? Like, you know, pick the pistol and only so many of them are loaded.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. This riddle is quite, I don't know, I got a little lost in it, but I'm glad Hermione was there to figure it out.
Oh yeah, I never could have figured this out.
Me too. I was like, okay, where's the battering ram spell? Okay,
Right.
Let me smash my way through this, okay? I don't understand what it's saying.
But Hermione is able to solve it, and they realize that there isn't enough for both of them to go through, so Harry goes, and Hermione's gonna stay back, and she's like, oh, Harry, you're a great wizard. I'm not as great as you. Me, said Hermione, books and cleverness. There are more important things, friendship and bravery. And oh, Harry, be careful. So again, Jess, this is why Hermione is in Gryffindor and not in Ravenclaw.
That makes sense. I can see more why, you know, just kind of like surface level, the assumption would be Ravenclaw, but as she's kind of more, is more nuanced, we understand why she is where she is.
She is a Ravendor.
She's a Ravendor. That's, I like that.
Yeah. Morgan, I don't know how familiar you are with the houses and their specific characteristics. Jess, if you had to give Morgan a hybrid house, what would it be?
Ooh, man. I probably would put you in Gryffindor. Some Hufflepuff tendencies.
Oh, so wow. Okay.
So he's a Gryffindor.
I think he would be a Gryffindor. Yes. I think so.
I took that, one of those, like, It's the test thing that they have, you know, on there.
Yeah.
And I thought, I was like, I'm going to get Gryffindor. And I got Ravenclaw.
That doesn't surprise me too much.
I don't know. Yeah. And I know, Amy, I'm not really knowledgeable on, like, the aspects of every house. Like, but it's funny. It's funny that just Gryffindor. Okay, I'm a Gryffindor. Okay.
Yes, you're a Gryffindor. And Gryffindor is the name of one of our tiers on Patreon. So check out that if you want to support us. And then the chapter ends with Harry going forth through the fire. But when he gets there, Snape isn't there, nor is Voldemort. And that's how the chapter ends.
And I don't get to know who it is until I read the next chapter next week.
Yep, that's again, hour and a half. Again, those were two very long, very intense chapters.
Yes, they were. I feel like there was so much in those. I was reading it. I was like, how can somebody pack this much into two chapters? It was a lot.
There was, like the first of chapter 15 felt longer, but I think chapter 16 in the audiobook one I was reading was like 42 minutes long or something like that.
Oh my god.
Yeah. It was so long. Like I remember looking at it and going, oh wow, that's okay. She crammed a bunch of stuff in there.
He crammed so much stuff in there.
He crammed, but sorry. Yeah, I'll get the hang of it eventually.
Yeah.
It's all good.
No, you'll be ready by the time you join us again for Chamber of Secrets.
Oh, yes, that's right.
What was that, Jess?
That was my little intro. I don't know.
Our little Vincent Price
haunting. Yeah, exactly. Bringing the gothic podcast to the Harry Potter.
Okay. Which is good because now it is time for Gothic Geek Out. So, Morgan, would you like to list all the elements within these chapters that you felt could fall in a gothic category?
Oh, dear God. Okay. let's see. We have trapdoors. We have, we have the school itself. Like, it's very architecturally, I feel like all I see is gothic. You have, like, the dark woods motif. You have the mythical creatures. And, you know, there's that magic kind of basis, too. Even if you take out the overt magic, you get the kind of secret, like there's something they're trying to uncover, and it's not something current, but it's something that you know, there's secrets in the past of this school that will come back to haunt them, you know. And mm-hmm. And there's, of course, you know, you've got your mentions of, you know, class and itself, like even the academic environment, some of the gothic nature of, like, you know, like alchemy or the history of magic you get in, like, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Frankenstein, like these alchemical type of studies where they're trying to unlock, you know, different types of things that are forbidden or taboo or lost. No, so there's just a couple anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting you say alchemy, because alchemy is technically, at least not that we know of, is a subject at Hogwarts. I like to think in my headcanon that alchemy is like an AP class that maybe the oldest students learn.
That's cool. Wow. Hey, we're learning to well, it's interesting too with the Philosopher's Stone, I guess, but you know, the actual Philosopher's Stone that, you know, from history is the, you know, the not an actual stone, but the recipe for being able to turn either lead to gold or the unlocking of being able to bring people back from the dead, you know. And so interesting.
Yeah. So Jess, again, your elements of gothic.
Well, Morgan covered a majority of them. The things that kind of stood out to me kind of at this point, there was a lot more magic than there were gothic things, I think. Mm-hmm. Magical things and gothic things. But the Forbidden Forest kind of reminded me of some gothicness. And then Filch and his love of torture and the chains and the dungeon. And I just think about all those, you know, the Castle of Otranto and different things like that.
I can't believe I forgot to mention that. Okay. Like,
that's all right. Now I feel that's bad. Why I'm here. I'm all about that.
The most obvious one is right in front of us.
Yeah. And that's why she wrote the paper on torture.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's my jam. Not at all.
Yeah, again, you kind of covered all of them. The only thing I will say is, again, definitely, I think, you know, gothic is more in chapter 15 than 16 with the Forbidden Forest, but I would like to notice just the vampiric nature, the way that Voldemort is presented to us, sucking the blood of a dead unicorn with silver blood dripping out down his front.
Yeah, that's pretty vampiric, you know? It's very dark and scary, and the silver blood kind of made me, well, they mentioned werewolves right before that.
So yeah, that was the most gothic thing I took away, is just the vampiric nature of Voldemort, at least in this form that he has. Because there's this question of, does he have a body? Does he not? Is he a ghost? Is he more than a ghost? Like, we don't really know at this point. But he currently is solid enough that he can kill a unicorn and drink its blood.
Not very cool. But I kind of wondered about his, like, physical presence at this point as well. But sure, I'll learn more soon.
Okay, and then we can move on to the Tarot of the Day exercise.
Yeah, I'm excited for this.
Here, let me bring it. And then, so I'm shuffling through. Oh, this is a good one. Oh, so, I just picked these at randoms. And what did I pick? I picked the number 13 of the Major Arcana. Death.
Oh, there we go.
Wow.
So here, you know, but death doesn't necessarily have to be like a physical death. It could be a spiritual death of some kind, more like rejuvenation or transformation. Here, let me pull up a definition.
Very appropriate card. I mean, with the introduction of Voldemort, when people initially think of the death card, you know, I guess when he maybe the devil card too. I don't know. I'm not super well versed in tarot.
I'm not versed in tarot, but you could like relate that card directly to them finding the dead unicorn as like the death of innocence type of thing. Mm. Like these freshmen, like I mean I don't know how many terrible things they've seen up to this point, but that probably ranks among them, you know. And Harry lost his parents. I guess that's a big one. But yeah, seeing a dead unicorn, which is kind of a personification of like what Amy said, purity, you know. Wow. And it's not just killed. It's like, oh, something killed and drank its blood. And this was not like, I'm going to put you down because you're sick. This was, I'm going to kill you and steal what I need from you. And
right.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I don't know. That might seem like that card might be appropriate.
I agree.
Yeah. So here we go. The death card symbolizes the end of a major phase or aspect of your life that you realize is no longer serving you, opening up the possibility of something far more valuable and essential. You must close one door to open another. You need to put the past behind you and part ways, ready to embrace new opportunities and possibilities. It may be difficult to let go of the past, but you will soon see its importance and promise of renewal and transformation. If you resist these necessary endings, you may experience pain both emotionally and physically. But if you exercise your imagination and visualize a new possibility, you allow more constructive patterns to emerge. So again, the symbolism of the unicorn, as Morgan said, the loss of innocence, and even Ronan, the centaur, says something to the effect of, oh, it's always the innocent who like die first.
Yeah, that's really dark. I think a little bit if we relate it to Harry too, kind of his loss of Voldemort just being this name that he can't say. It's a very real presence in his life. So there's a little bit of loss of innocence in that regard. He can't just kind of, you know, I mean, I think he always knows it's something, but now the reality of it is right there in front of him. Moreover,
just the death of Voldemort as an idea and the birth of Voldemort as a legitimate threat to my well-being.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, which I think a lot of people have gone throughout this pandemic, whether you totally believed it was a hoax or not, you know, and just, you know, intellectually you can understand it, and then it just got worse and worse and worse, and you're like, oh shit.
Right. Yeah. Right. And we're
still my movie theaters that I loved so much.
Oh, Morgan. I am right there with you. You have no, I want to go to a movie so bad.
Heavy movie goer?
I was.
Oh yeah.
And I know Morgan was. Yeah.
I used to be when I was younger. I've just felt like they've gotten so expensive and inflated that it kind of lost its appeal to me.
I used to be able to go for free in my hometown, so like where Morgan and I met. So I would go all the time, and then I moved, and I didn't go as frequently in the past few years. But it, for some reason, that is the thing that I'm like, I just want to go and buy a giant bucket of popcorn and sit in a movie. That's all I want.
And then the death card, you know, we referred to chapter 15, but chapter 16, again, just showing, you know, each of Harry, Ron, and Hermione have to, like, let go of their, like, weaknesses and have to show, like, their strong points. So it is an evolution and a transformation in their characters where they each use their strengths and sometimes they have to sacrifice themselves. So, again, entering this realm of, I've gone from just being a famous kid's best friend to like, I'm a ride or die loyal friend.
Yeah.
Literally ride or die.
Yeah. Possibly die. Yes, absolutely.
And then our last exercise is fan fiction time. So yeah, we basically think of, you know, again, if something had happened slightly differently, how would that have panned out? How would that have changed things? So Jess, what was your scenario?
So I went with something, and I feel like this was kind of an obvious one, is what if it were Ron and Harry, or Harry and Ron, to solve the logic puzzle rather than Hermione and Harry? Like, would they have figured it out? How long would it have taken them? I just don't think it would have been as, wouldn't have ended as pretty as it did, since, you know, Hermione was there to kind of use the logic and solve the puzzle.
Interesting. Yeah, because again, it's hard for me to conceptualize that, because again, reading these so many times, I know so well the symbolism of each character's strength and using that strength within these various challenges. So for Hermione to not have that as her challenge, and for Ron to do it, you know, I'm going to be one of those people where Again, I don't think it's Ron's problem that he's not smart. Like, again, clearly, by being able to do chess, like, I suck at chess. Like, to play chess shows you have a very... He just has a very different type of intelligence from Hermione. His is more about the predictability of human behavior.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and maybe I've been one of those people. The thing that I say is, it's not, are you smart? It's how are you smart? Because I think that some of the abilities of the three kids are used, you know, they show their strengths here. And I don't think Ron's a complete ding dong. I think he has his smarts, and chess isn't easy.
Mm-hmm. So my scenario was, what if they had been nicer to Neville and brought them into their circle? And what if Neville had joined them through the trapdoor?
Do we think there might have been like a situation with, just given his history? I like Neville. I think he's great. I think we probably, you know, don't give him enough credit, but he does at this point in the series tend to kind of like be a little clumsy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it might not have worked out. Something might have happened at some point.
Yeah.
The only thing I think of, it's common knowledge that the only thing that Neville is good at this point is herbology.
Mm.
And so the idea is, a lot of people have speculated that, you know, just as the others have like their moments with the various challenges, Neville could have contributed to this by immediately knowing what the plant was and knowing how to get rid of it.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't really think about that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, maybe it doesn't specifically state it, but yeah, it's like, but in the early books, it's common knowledge that the only thing at this point Neville is any good at is like magical plants.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, especially in this world where they kill you.
Right. Yeah, probably a really good thing.
Yeah. Morgan, did you think of a scenario?
I mean, yes, it may be a little overly complex, but see, what if Hagrid and Harry and them happened upon Voldemort in his weakened form, and Hagrid just put two in his head with the crossbow, and then they call Neville in, and they're like, Neville, there's people that cast spells, and there's people who dig, and you dig. And they bring Neville in, like you said, he digs the hole, they throw Voldemort in there, end of story, we're done.
I mean, the fact that this came from you, Morgan, is not surprising at all. So I think it definitely took the story in a much different direction.
Yeah, that might not have been a kid's story there, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No.
I don't write kid's fiction.
That's... No, I read your fiction. This is like, yeah, that's pretty on brand for you.
Would have definitely taken a big chunk of the series out. There are enough secondary villains for it to hobble on a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I kind of killed it there. My bad.
I did that already. I did it like way early on. So don't.
She had a scenario where Hermione got killed in chapter 10.
I did.
Oh, wow.
And we had the wonderful Amanda and Kevin from the podcast Fox and the Foxhound. And everybody kind of like, I felt like the dumb kid in class after I proposed that, because it was like, oh God, I can't believe that. And I was like, oh. Whoops.
And again, Morgan, we also brought up the point that if she had died, Ron and Harry would have died.
See, like, if Neville, like, somehow buys it, like, I mean, nothing's really lost, at least in my knowledge. I'm sure I'm wrong, but, you know.
See, that's my biggest, like, I know he's important, but I don't know how he's important. That's my biggest hole in Harry Potter knowledge, is why is he so important? Because everybody is, like, totally thinks he's great. And I still don't know why, and nobody will spoil it for me. So I'm going to find out.
Yeah, at least he'd know where to see it. Well, you mentioned the herbology or herbalism trait that he's good at. You know, at least he would know right where to dig. Like, see, it ties in with mine.
There you go. There you go. Perfect.
Alrighty then. And that concludes this episode 8 of the Rambling Raven Pups. Thank you so much for joining us, Morgan.
You're welcome. I did plenty of rambling, that's for sure.
Yeah. And Morgan will be joining us next season for another episode of Harry Potter, but in the Chamber of Secrets, where we also make another trip into the Forbidden Forest. But we'll get to that later. And then next week, we shall be doing the last chapter, The Man with Two Faces. And then a wrap-up sort of interview of where I've prepared a variety of questions that I'll ask you and just general reflections on the first book.
Oh, man. Okay. I feel like maybe I should reread it again. It'll be pop quiz time or something. But I can't believe it's been like this is I can't believe this is the last chapter. That's
crazy. Indeed. So, yeah. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.